Hello, good afternoon. My name is Ann Cavall, and on behalf of the Breast Cancer Education Association Board and Volunteers, I welcome you to the BCEA webinar series. This is a special webinar as it is a topic backed by popular demand. We held an initial conversation about breast reconstruction webinar in August 2017 and received so many questions we could not get to them all. You spoke and we listened, and we welcome everyone back today to continue this conversation and learn more about breast reconstruction. We have participants joining us in two ways, via webcast or by phone. For those connected via webcast, please follow along with the slideshow on your screen. Also, for those connected via the webcast, you should see a box to the left of the slides where you'll be able to submit even more questions throughout this webinar. Please do submit questions. We always want to hear from you. 2018 will again be a year that BCEA continues to expand our mission by providing breast cancer educational resources. This year's educational programming will continue to encourage, engage, and empower those affected by breast cancer in a variety of ways, including webinars such as this one offered throughout the year, also through our signature education conference, which is scheduled for October 6, 2018, at the TIES Conference Center in St. Paul, Minnesota. This conference will deliver the most up-to-date information on breast cancer treatments and nutrition, a mobile mammography unit on-site, and many roundtable discussions that connect attendees on the most pressing breast health topics. Please mark your calendar for October 6th, and we hope to see you there. Please also tap into ongoing resources on our website and social media channels available 24/7. If you are unable to attend any of our previous webinars, including the first part of this topic, recordings of these sessions are available on the BCEA website at www.breastcancereducation.org under the webinar tab. This is a great, easy way to access valuable information and at your convenience. The BCEA also welcomes your involvement in our organization. We welcome participation on all levels and have many different types of volunteer opportunities available, whether it's just for an hour a year or a couple hours a month. We have exciting plans for 2018 and hope that you can help us deliver education empowerment to those fighting breast cancer. And while the BCEA is definitely serious about providing quality breast health education, we also like to have a lot of fun. We welcome you to join us at our upcoming The Breast Spiel Ever, a curling fundraiser coming up in a few weeks on Saturday, March 3rd at Dakota Curling in Lakeville, Minnesota. Please join us for a night of fun and learn a storied sport. Your participation and support is what allows BCEA to continue to offer important education such as these free webinars. If you have not done so already, please be sure to connect with us on social media. We regularly share and foster discussion on the latest news and resources in breast cancer detection, diagnosis, treatment, and survivorship. We also encourage you to share what you learned today using hashtag BCEAWebinar. Lastly, please also be sure to keep your eye out for more information on our upcoming webinars in 2018. We will share specific information on upcoming webinars and our October conference as soon as complete details are available. And now I'd like to introduce our speakers for today's webinar. Dr. Mark Migliori of MMK Plastic Surgery in Edina is a board-certified plastic surgeon. He received his medical degree from Brown University and completed his general surgery and plastic surgery residency at the University of Minnesota. Dr. Sumi Tuttle is also a board-certified plastic surgeon and received her medical degree from the University of Texas Health Science Center at Houston and completed her residency at Drexel University College. She also completed a fellowship in plastic surgery at the University of Minnesota. Welcome, Dr. Migliori and Dr. Tuttle.
Great. Thank you, Ann. That's very nice introduction. We appreciate it, and we mostly appreciate the opportunity to do this again. We really enjoyed the last time that we had this conversation, and we wanted to advance the conversation. So, again, thank you for that opportunity, and hello, Dr. Tuttle. Good to talk to you on the phone again.
Yes, happy to be here.
Great. One of the things that we showed in the previous webinar were some resources that we think have been particularly vetted, and I think there are good resources for any patient trying to advance their understanding of these particular topics. So, again, Anne had mentioned that there is a recording of our previous conversation available on the BCEA website. But Dr. Tuttle and I are both members of the American Society of Plastic Surgery organization, and the plasticsurgery.org is a site that has a number of great informative features for patients and particularly about breast reconstruction. So there are a number of things, and if you go to that site and navigate over to the breast reconstruction tabs, you can find a wealth of information, and you know, the internet by itself can be a little bit overwhelming, so this is usually a very good place to start, and that we would certainly encourage anybody to use that resource if this kind of information is important to them. So one, as we went through the webinar a few months ago, we had received some questions in advance, and we had received some while we were speaking, and we tried to give a broad overview and incorporate the answers in our broad overview, but oftentimes it is better to specifically just answer the question that was sent to us, and so we decided that a second conversation where we literally print out the questions and give answers. It'll probably be a springboard to other topics as we talk, so this will be fairly free form, but not unlike what a patient or anyone else would expect if they actually had a consultation with a plastic surgeon. We tend to have conversations that help direct patients to what their questions are, and this is the type of answers that we would give, and so it's not particularly rehearsed, and I hope that you find that helpful, because we want to be able to make this meaningful to anyone who is participating here. So, Dr. Tuttle, anything you want to add to that?
No, it was a great opportunity to, I think, you know, discuss the general reconstructive options and things like that. But we did run out of time, so I'm really looking forward to answering some of these specific questions.
Great. So we'll get started, and I think we'll just take them in the orders that we have them listed. We tried to group them a little bit into various categories, and so we'll go from there. And usually what we do is I'll have Dr. Tuttle kind of give her basic response to these. I'll add to it, and then we'll move through. So we'll start with the first question.
Yeah, the first question is, please explain different types of reconstruction and the recovery time for each. We could talk a long time about the details of the different types of reconstruction, but typically when I see a patient in consultation, I like to break it down to implant-based reconstruction or autologous, which basically means using your own tissue to have the reconstruction. There is another type of reconstruction that kind of combines both, which is using a different type of muscle from your back and using implants as well to help with that reconstruction. So those are the two big different schools of thought, but then you have another sector where you can use both. When I say implant-based reconstruction, we're mainly discussing expanders and the use of silicone or saline implants for that reconstruction. That can be done at the time of the mastectomy, or it can be done in a delayed fashion. The autologous reconstruction, typically there are different body parts that you can use, but most commonly we will use the lower abdominal skin and fat, and you may have heard the terms TRAM or a DIEP flap, which is a perforator flap, and the TRAM muscle basically stands for the transverse abdominis muscle that we would be either using or using the DIEP flap, which is the small vessels that get to the soft tissue. I'm trying to just simplify it so that it's somewhat easy to understand, but if I had diagrams, it would be a little easier to explain that. And then a combination of the two could be the latissimus flap, which is the muscle and some portion of the skin from your back, and a tissue expander or an implant. that's a general overview. Do you want to take
general,
on the recovery?
From a recovery point of view,
yeah.
What would you say?
What would I say? Oh, you know, I would say that for the implant-based reconstruction, generally I usually say 4 to 6 weeks. With the abdominal tissue transfer, I typically say about 3 months before you feel like you're back to normal, but everyone is a little bit different. Latissimus flap, I would say generally anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah, I think the general rule of thumb is that the implant-based reconstructions are usually they're multiple stages with shorter recoveries for each stage.
Yes.
The autologous flap tends to be a longer recovery, but usually fewer stages as a general rule. And I think that a key thing that we emphasized in our last webinar is that the choice between these is not choosing between a good quality reconstruction that takes longer and a low quality one that's faster. It's mm-hmm. Our expectations and the goals for any type of reconstruction is the same, and that's basically to get a patient to a place where they say they don't think about their breast and they feel a sense of balance and wholeness. Not every operation is available to every patient, and there are pros and cons to all of them, and it's about individualizing which one makes the most sense for any given expectation of what the final result will be. So oftentimes an implant-based reconstruction gives a superior result in a certain kind of patient, and oftentimes an autologous gives a superior result. So it's not a matter of choosing between different levels of quality. It's about choosing the right operation to accomplish the task.
Yes, absolutely. And that's where the consultation with the plastic surgeon is very helpful because, again, it's an overview, but there are definitely pros and cons to any type of reconstruction.
I think it's fair to say that when we do reconstruction, and I think this is kind of embedded in this question, it's about a year before mm-hmm. we feel like we're complete with the reconstruction.
Absolutely.
And so I think an awareness of that is important. This is a disruptive process no matter how we do it, but hopefully with important gains at the end of it. But being prepared for the entire process at the beginning, I think, is a key part of that consultation.
Mm-hmm.
So
both doctors, you did really get into this heavier on the first webinar as well. So
right,
anyone
right.
that may have missed that can also refer back to that.
And about the consultation, we talked in the previous webinar about how important that consultation is. But the question here about before and after pictures and what's our approach in terms of what kind of pictures do we show? I'll let you answer, and I suspect we'll have the same answer to this, Dr. Tuttle.
Yes. So before and after pictures of past patients, but what percentage of reconstructions actually achieve good results? You know, I think there's a lot of variables in achieving the best results possible, and I do that in quotations. Before and after pictures, yes, they generally tend to be really very nice results, something that we want the patient to walk away feeling comfortable with and is representative of our work. I do think that no reconstruction is perfect. I think it's a matter of accepting some of the asymmetries or regularities and those types of things that come with reconstruction. I think it's important to set a patient's expectation realistically. So personally, I don't show just my best results, but I want to give a representation of what kind of results a patient could expect and what with different body types, et cetera. And, you know, there are, at least in my, repertoire of cases and patients that I've seen, I've had some A-plus results, if I can say so myself, and I've had some results that I feel like could have been much better. If I had to grade myself, maybe a D. I always personally, would like to strive for the A-plus results, but oftentimes if I had to grade myself again, it'd be more like a B-plus to an A-minus. And to me, I'm very happy with that. But ultimately, What's important, too, is how the patient feels about themselves. And I've had situations where I felt like I could improve on a result, but the patient was very happy and content, even with the imperfections that I could see. And so, you know, I always say the patient is the captain, and they drive how much further we take the reconstruction.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think most of us try to show representative pictures of where we expect to get in any given case, and most of us have a big catalog of photos that we don't show the whole catalog. We show the ones that are pertinent to maybe what the patient is facing in terms of their body type and what can happen with thickened scars and those kinds of things. So I think trying to have that honest conversation that we never do get it perfect. We can't make it look as if there was no mastectomy. But our goal is to get people to a place where they say they don't think about their breast and therefore don't think about the mastectomy. And I think that the patient drives that. And it can be a moving target. The patient at one point in their reconstruction say, this is perfect for me now. And because they've been through an ordeal up to that point. And then a few years later, reevaluate the result and say, you know, there's indentation or there's irregularity. Can this be fixed? And to me, that's a sign of being philosophically cured or emotionally cured, because if it becomes an art project, then it's not a cancer project. And I think that's the good thing about that is we have, for the most part, laws in place that allow us to continue to maintain symmetry over time, so that from an insurance point of view, we can try to push the envelope. And as new procedures like fat grafting, et cetera, get developed, we can advance an individual patient's result over time too. So it's I think that the pictures are important stepping off points, but it's as much about the conversation in terms of creating the appropriate expectation.
And can I just add here too, I just think also when radiation enters into the picture, that can truly affect the ultimate reconstruction. And it may not be as evident maybe initially, but with time and given some years, I think that can also impact that as well. So I know that's not exactly part of the question, but that definitely can affect the, I think, ultimate outcome of the reconstruction.
Absolutely. Radiation will always affect the ultimate result. You can never get to the same place of symmetry when radiation is involved. That doesn't mean we can't have an effective reconstruction, but it's more complicated to get there. But another way to answer this question is that when we look at satisfaction studies of reconstructions, patients saying that they have basically a very good to excellent reconstruction, it's in the high, close to 90%. And the questions are usually not so much do you have a perfect appearance, is that are you satisfied, are you happy you did reconstruction, would you do it again, those kinds of things. So that's pretty telling. And that's true of all types and all types of mastectomy, nipple sparing, non-nipple sparing, that it's about the process of getting to a place of empowerment and recovery. And I think that we get to go on that survivorship journey with patients, which is sort of a nice little secret for the plastic surgeons, is that we actually follow patients a lot longer than anybody else, and that's a real privilege for us. There's a question here about how would you read your surgery that has drooped and spread to the sides? And I suspect that most of the time when this has happened, it's usually in a setting of an implant-based reconstruction, where over time when a patient lays down, the implant shifts to the side and goes off to the side. So how would you answer that, Dr. Tuttle?
Yes, I would say just by reading the question, it sounds like there may be an issue with the pocket, and depends on what kind of implant you use, et cetera, but I'm just going to assume that this was a smooth implant and that has just kind of the pocket has gotten out of control. And if that is the case, it's an implant-based reconstruction, I would oftentimes, evaluate the patient, see what the patient would like improved, what they like about the reconstruction, what they don't like about the reconstruction. Usually, if it's been several years, there may be some ptosis, which means stretching and dropping of the, droopiness to the breast. Sometimes you can have a paucity of upper pole fullness, and what I mean by that is the upper area of the breast may seem a little bit hollow. So if that's the case, we evaluate to see if I need to remove some extra skin to tighten up that to perform sort of like a breast lift, or I may have to go internally as well and tighten up that pocket, so laterally, which is on the sides, and along the IMF, which is the inframammary fold. Oftentimes I may have to place sutures and things like that to kind of narrow down that pocket so the implant doesn't have an opportunity to move everywhere. Another technique in approaching this could be changing the texture of the smooth implant to a textured implant. And we may be getting on this topic later, but some patients may not want the textured implant due to a rare blood cell cancer, which is a very rare blood cell cancer, which is associated with it, called ALCL, anaplastic large cell lymphoma.
So you talked about the insurance, or the availability of insurance in, on revisions. So are there insurance limits on the revision, and would a removal and replacement of implants be included in that?
Yeah, so for most insurance companies, there's not like a number of cases then you have to be done, and there's not a limit that if you need to do it within a certain time period. Will some attempt to limit without naming particular insurance company names? I've had a particular insurance company try to suggest that there was enough symmetry that a revision was really a cosmetic thing. Usually it's not that hard a fight to ensure that it's covered, but and I don't think it would go there. I think this is about a particular insurance company that's kind of known for making things difficult. So in general, I would say that that seems to be a non-issue for us, and even to the point where we don't need to do prior authorization because of the certain codes that we would use in a revision reconstruction. It's covered and really without much hassle at all. So I can't speak for every insurance company, but in general, at least as it stands today, that's how we that's what we experience, certainly in my office. So
excellent. Are we ready for the next question?
Sure. Well, I'll just add with that revision surgery with the redo. So I'm very much a believer in that if you can control the pocket around the implant, create a foundation for it, that does more to define what the breast looks like than the implant, that the various choices we have for implants are nuanced, but the real effect of creating a nice fold, creating a nice shaped breast that has give but doesn't move is by controlling that pocket. And so I tend to do a lot of internal suturing and fixation of the tissues to make the implant stay where I want, and really trying to reconcile the size of the implant, the volume of the implant, and the base width of the implant to match the chest wall. So I think that's the art of what we do. I think that, yes, that can be fixed. And it's usually a surgery that is under general anesthetic, takes about an hour to hour and a half, but it usually can be made significantly better for anyone that has the symptoms that were mentioned in that question. Now we can move ahead.
Excellent. Now we move on to reconstruction for mastectomy or lumpectomy.
The question reads, what information can you provide over the years? The lumpectomy breast reconstruction has shrunken so that the cancer's breast is almost twice as large. What can be done to make them more equal in size? Yes. So, yes, oftentimes, as you can see, that radiation can cause a shrinkage of the affected breast. And when I see patients in my office for consultation regarding this, I usually discuss many, depending on what the defect is, if there's scar tissue, if the nipple has been distorted, et cetera. But let's just say it's just a size mismatch. Oftentimes, we will discuss potentially altering the larger breast if they are okay with going smaller to match that radiated breast. But with the understanding that although more changes happen in that first year after radiation, as the years go on, there may continue to be some changes to that radiated breast. There's no guarantee or promise. So that's one option that we could consider. Sometimes in that radiated breast, if there is scar tissue that is tethering or things like that, I can oftentimes do some scar releasing with some fat grafting in that area to help correct some of those defects. Sometimes we need multiple rounds of fat grafting to help us achieve a little more volume on that side. But typically, my recommendation is to manipulate the non-radiated breast if we could have that opportunity, because that radiated tissue just behaves very differently. And if we operate on that radiated breast, sometimes, you know, you set yourself up for potential increased risks and complications.
This question highlights the incredible unpredictability of what happens with radiation. So for some patients, the radiation effect seems to be relatively minor. There's always an effect. It always tends to tighten the skin, so the nipple position usually elevates, and the breast usually shrinks some. So for some patients, in the ideal lumpectomy, it's a minimum amount such that no reconstruction is needed. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, in some patients, it can be a significant change. And in that setting, to try to operate in the setting of radiation, we do it and it's safe, but the expectation of the result is that the radiated side tends not to change once you get it into position, and the other breast continues to change. So there may be other procedures down the road that are done over time if the non-treated breast or non-cancer breast basically increases or decreases in size. And so, in general, making the non-radiated side smaller to match the radiated side is safer than, say, putting implants in to try to make the radiated side larger, because that tends to create unsatisfactory scarring called a capsular contracture on the implant. So I think lumpectomy and mastectomy reconstructions that involve radiation are the hardest things that we have to do. And the lumpectomy patients can often have enough deformity that it actually ends up being easier to convert them to a mastectomy and get a reconstruction. That happens, you know, in a minority of the time, but sometimes because of the defect, there's no way to preserve the breast, and it's actually better to do a full mastectomy with a reconstruction. So it's a complex decision-making process. And the other little curveball is that from a pure legal statute point of view, the law that allows us to do reconstruction that we just talked about is really specifically about mastectomy. It really doesn't cover lumpectomy changes. So if a patient is a Medicare patient, we know it's not covered at all. There is no way to cover it because of the radiation. So it can have significant asymmetries, but Medicare will not cover lumpectomy reconstruction. Some of the private insurers will follow Medicare's lead. In Minnesota, we have had the major players in the private insurance sector have generally covered lumpectomy because they view the law as more about reconstruction following breast cancer treatment, but it's not a given. And so that adds a little bit of a wrinkle depending on the patient's age and their insurance coverage. So usually we do have to write for prior authorization for lumpectomy reconstruction?
Yes.
Can move ahead?
Yeah, sure.
So now we have questions on implants.
Yes, so please explain the difference, pros and cons of silicone versus saline implants. There are definitely pros and cons. Silicone is, I would say that the pro for silicone implants is that they have, and they can come in textured versus smooth, and saline also can come in textured versus smooth. Saline implants are filled with sterile salt water, basically. They call it saline. And silicone implants are made out of, are filled with silicone. And the newer generation silicone implants are oftentimes much more cohesive than the former. And the trade-off is that they can feel a little bit firmer. I would say that in my practice, the majority of the time, I oftentimes let the patient feel and choose which implants they prefer, and oftentimes they like the feel of the silicone implants. Some of the questions that I get are, will these rupture? Do they last forever? And yes, silicone or saline implants both can rupture. With the silicone implant, it's very difficult externally to tell if there's been a rupture or not, so it will require further imaging, such as an MRI. The FDA recommends, but it is not a requirement, to get an MRI after the first 3 years and every 2 years thereafter after the placement of a silicone implant. The saline implant is rather more obvious when there is a rupture because it basically deflates. And so, And so oftentimes the patient, sometimes if they feel very strongly about being able to tell if there's a problem, they may opt for the saline implants. But again, based on feeling, textures, patients will oftentimes choose the silicone implants.
And I think there's an important thing to understand that all implants have silicone. So the saline implant, it has a silicone shell filled with salt water. The silicone implant is a silicone shell filled with a gel made up of the same molecules but just cross-linked less. So it's not that one implant and expanders as well, it's not that one implant has silicone molecule and the other doesn't. And there's a question later on about safety of silicone, so I'll save my comments about actual silicone safety till then. But the implants, we generally can use the same techniques with each implant, but it's the texture, the feel, the comfort level. And so that is a very important conversation that occurs at the time of using the implant, whether it's after an expander or if you're going direct to an implant. I think that there is a difference in rupture rates between them. And in general, at 10 years, the saline implants, because they're stiffer, have about a 1% per year rupture rate, so it's about 10%. And silicone seems to be somewhere closer to half of that. And it's hard to know because of this idea of what we call silent rupture, meaning a patient may have a silicone implant and it looks fine, it feels fine, it's not causing any problems, but if we do an MRI, it may show a rupture. It's really hard to know because not everybody gets MRIs exactly what the rate is. But the implications are different. Obviously, a saline implant, if it ruptures because it deflates, it's a bit of a clothing emergency in the sense that there will be asymmetry within a day or so. Whereas a silicone implant, if we know it's ruptured, in general, it's not an emergency to get it changed. And there might even be some patients where we elect to leave the implant in place because it's not causing problem and it won't cause problem, and they may have a medical condition that the surgery is more risk to them than the ruptured implant. So as far as how long do breast implants last, could they last forever? They can. Patients, there are patients that have had implants in the 1970s and they're still in. We tell patients that it's not intended to be a lifelong device and it may have to be changed, but we don't change it on a timetable. It's not changed every number of years because that's when it wears out. It's changed when there's an issue. And if you look at the data, from the time of finishing reconstruction to 10 years later, the odds of needing another surgery or having another surgery is probably around 30 or 40%. the lowest reason for that is rupture of the implant. The most common reason is because something has changed about the look, and the goal is to, you know, regain the symmetry that was once had. So in general, an implant-based reconstruction at least demands a continued relationship with the plastic surgeon over time to continue to have the conversation about what do you do about the implant. And I tend to see patients yearly if they'll come in because I feel like when an implant's placed, I should be the one worrying about it, not the patient.
I agree with you completely, and I usually love to see patients yearly. That's what I tell them, because they'll ask, like, when should I see you next? And I'll say yearly, but my feelings won't be hurt if you don't see me, but I definitely need to know if there's any changes that happens.
Yeah, and most of us keep our you know, we keep our charts open, so if a patient is lost for 3 or 4 years and then comes in because they just want to know that everything's okay,
yes.
It's not a matter of any problem, and with the records, we keep all the records forever.
Yes. And, you know, when I see my patients, I'll kind of joke with them and say it's not an oil change. It's not like at 10 years you look at your watch and go, oh,
right.
Got to get my implants exchanged. So.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So we'll move on to this. Some questions about patient having a question about having expanded in and maybe wanting to abandon the process. What happens there? Or, you know, and the next question is sort of the same. If you stop the process, what happens to the extra skin? I'll let you manage that.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, depending on how much you expanded and things like that, when you do remove it, because that expander is quite stiff and has a lot of projection, you will notice immediately that there is deflation of that tissue. And depending on how large you expanded depends on how much excess skin you have. But oftentimes, more immediately, you'll notice a concavity to your chest because there's just that extra skin. And it's not like you have small breasts, but rather just a lot of extra skin against your chest wall, because a lot of that breast tissue has been removed. And you can sometimes, you know, that when the scar tissue forms initially, patients can kind of feel almost like they're feeling their ribs. So there is some changes. Now, what can you do about that after? Oftentimes, we like to wait several months so that scar tissue can really soften. If you're looking more for just the flat chest, you can have some excision of that extra skin, and you can have that excision of that extra skin at the time of the initial tissue expander removal if that's the pathway you'd like to go. Sometimes what we've done, and some of my patients who've had mastectomies, they'll come in and ask me, well, what options do I have now? Either what bugs them is that they can feel their rib, or they just don't like being completely flat. And so we've discussed, and I've done some fat grafting, serial fat grafting, because oftentimes you can't do it in just one surgery. But we've done serial fat grafting and built, you know, from a flat chest to like a size B cup breast, which is small, but it makes the patient feel more confident in clothes, and they like the fact that they don't have a prosthesis there. Do you have anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, so I think that in general the skin shrinks pretty well, so there's usually some tailoring of the skin if you take out an expander, but not much. And the goal usually is to convert the chest wall to something that would be amenable to wearing an external prosthesis if the person wanted to. In other words, if it's completely irregular with a lot of extra skin, particularly as it goes out to the sides, that can be as difficult to wear something over as a poorly shaped reconstruction. So sometimes the fat grafting is actually just to create a smoother shape. So you take the expander out, you tailor the skin, you allow things to settle, and sometimes you're just doing it to create a smooth platform so that if a patient wants to wear an external prosthesis, that's possible. So a patient can always decide if a reconstructive process is the right thing for them, and they can change their mind. And then our job is to try to figure out, well, what's the goal? What do we want it to look like? And you know, try to come up with a tissue rearrangement plan that will get the patient to a place where they say, they're more satisfied than being part of the reconstructive process. You know, an external prosthesis is a breast reconstruction.
Absolutely.
It needs to be viewed that. And, in fact, if we're going to do a surgical reconstruction, we need to at least be better than that. And when sometimes we can't because of some tissue factors, and if that's the case, sometimes it's best not to do the reconstruction or to abandon it. So this isn't—it's not that common, but it's also something that we've all done, and we've all—you know—we all have a process for how to get a patient through this step if it's necessary.
And I just wanted to emphasize that, you know, can you stop the reconstruction during the process? I mean, ultimately, you're the captain of your body and what you desire. And I think it's definitely, if you're doing the expanders and you're just like, you know what, I really don't, this is not for me, you can have it removed. I mean, you can discuss this with your plastic surgeon. I had a patient who was reconstructed by one of my partners who had retired, and she had a beautiful reconstruction. She had some radiation on one breast, and she just did not want the implants anymore. And despite how good she looked, we did go ahead and remove those implants because she just did not feel like it was for her, and she had capsular contracture on that radiated side, and it just wasn't worth the pain for her, and she's much happier now.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned fat grafting, and we did get a question about it. They asked to explain the process, but they had specific questions such as, is there a limitation that the body gives you in terms of liposuction, and do you ever go in with the intentions of taking a certain amount of fat out, then not being able to get at it?
I don't know about not being able to get at it. Do you mean having access to enough fat?
Yeah, I think, you know, I would suspect that the question is, you know, that right now, and maybe in the future, we're going to be able to develop something that we can buy in the store, right? Some sort of material that will work like fat grafting. But right now, the concept is we do liposuction, we approach it like cosmetic liposuction. So for most mm-hmm. of us, we decide on which areas we're going to liposuction, and we liposuction it to a contour of the place we're taking it from that we feel is optimal. In that process, there's usually some sort of trap that collects the fat cells, and we see what we get from there, and we decide where to distribute it. So there are times where either a patient is thin enough or they've had certain surgeries where there's a limit to the amount of graft we can harvest. And in that situation, we have to prioritize where are we putting the fat graft. There are other times where we get a little bit more graft than we need, but that's what the section of the body that we're suctioning demanded in order to leave a nice contour in that area. It's been really amazing to me that I can there are patients who are thinner who can give a lot of very useful graft, and some of the patients who are heavier where the graft ends up not being as effective because it's more fibrous. And so I can't usually tell preoperatively how much fat I'm going to get, so I don't say, well, I'm going to suction until I get this many cc's of fat, then I'm going to stop. I usually plan things I almost always suction the abdomen and the flank area, plus or minus the inner and outer thighs. I mean, kind of the classic places that I use because they tend to be donor sites that patients are not they tend to be fine with me taking graft from those areas. And then I see what I get, and then I use it and distribute it. And these days I tend to put in fat grafts as like a thick blanket over the entire breast. So it's not like adding volume to the breast to make it. So you can put in 300 cc's of fat, but you're not making. It's not like putting in a 300 cc greater sized implant, because you're actually distributing it often where the implant isn't, or where the breast mount isn't from the tram flap. So it's become a mainstay of what we do, but there are some limits, and in some patients, either they've had suction before or they're so thin that there's really just a limit to how much graft, because the goal is not to create a dent in the donor area. Mm-hmm. And so it is an aesthetic operation in the donor area to not create something that we don't want in that area.
Absolutely. And some of my thinner patients, I have, unless I absolutely felt like I really needed to harvest the fat, some of us, you know, after discussion, we just said, you know, I don't think I'll be able to really, I don't think it'd be worth harvesting that fat in order to have that small amount of, harvest for me for the contour irregularity or whatnot. And so we talk about that ahead of time, and we kind of evaluate it after we do that second stage. And if we need to go back and do some fat grafting, it would require potentially putting the patient in a prone position, which is maybe harvesting from their back and other areas as well.
Right. We'll move on to some of the side effects of breast reconstruction. And this first question is an important one. Is that how common is it for side effects of nerve pain, muscle pain, muscle soreness to last after reconstruction? And person relaying that they're 6 years out and it's still an issue. And I think it is important to know that this is a lifelong consideration. And there are some patients that have some awareness, if nothing else, of the reconstruction and or discomfort. The majority of patients that have that, there's usually a reason. There's almost always radiation involved on one side or another and creating a lot of stiffness. But it certainly can happen. And to the point, as Dr. Tuttle said, that every once in a while, maybe once a year or so, there's a patient who has a reconstruction that is otherwise looks reasonable, but it's just there's enough awareness or discomfort that they just ask to have the reconstruction removed. But fat grafting has become a very effective modality for treating some of the chronic chest wall pain because of some of the tethering between the skin and the muscle. But this can be difficult, and I think it may involve some complementary therapies like acupuncture or a physical therapist who might be skilled at myofascial release or cupping or a number of different modalities. And I know I have a group of physical therapists and complementary therapists that can. That I can call upon if I feel like we haven't solved those problems. So it's important not to give up, but it can be frustrating.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not just the reconstruction or the fault of the reconstruction per se that's causing issues, but it's having had surgery and scar tissue in a particular area as well. And sometimes in some of my patients, I don't necessarily do this for a lot of my patients, but some of the patients who have had their reconstruction under the pectoralis muscle, and it's not very often, that this would happen, but some people really have a lot of spasm in their pectoralis muscle, and we've done trials of Botox into that area, and it is, approved by insurance to do this. And they note that they do have some improvement in that discomfort secondary to temporarily paralyzing that muscle or weakening it. But then that's not necessarily the solution to every situation, but it is a case-by-case. But again, there is scar tissue just from having had surgery, and that may not resolve in just because it's been 6 years or more after surgery.
And there are clearly syndromes where patients have never had reconstruction, but they have a post-mastectomy syndrome, which is some chronic discomfort in the chest just related to the mastectomy as well. So it's kind of hard to, untangle all of it, but the key thing is to not give up hope and to continue to be open to answers that otherwise you may not have thought of. So working with your surgeon and their colleagues to see if they can try some other therapies. We talked a little bit about the symptoms of implant rupture and that a saline implant obviously it deflates and so it's being asymmetry, but silicone, there are no classic symptoms, and that's why there's this phenomenon of silent rupture, where you can have a ruptured implant that looks good, feels fine, maintains its shape because the gel is very cohesive, and it generally, because it is so cohesive, stays within the scar capsule around the implant, so it doesn't tend to migrate as the implants of previous eras, which had more oil in them, tended to do. So the things that we would watch for is a change in the shape, a distortion of the shape, a palpable lump that would represent a granuloma or a reaction around some ruptured silicone, or a patient that has a real soft result and that suddenly becomes firm and suddenly gets a over the course of a few months gets a hard scar capsule, that would at least prompt some investigation to see if the implant is ruptured. But the best test, although we do exams, and if I always tell patients, if I can feel the edge of the implant's probably fine. But in some patients, you can't. And the best test is an MRI. And the MRI is it's a specific type of MRI that's designed to look at implants. I think the important thing is maintaining a continued relationship with the plastic surgeon and making sure that is an ongoing relationship so that if there are changes that are visible, it prompts the idea of getting an MRI, because it's basic, for the most part, a symptomless occurrence with a silicone implant.
So Dr. Migliori, I just want to get a clarification, because we did get that question. So that MRI to see about implant rupture is a specific MRI for purpose. It's not the same as an MRI that would be found in a routine six-month screening.
Right. So an MRI, and I can't speak to this like a radiologist would, but it's essentially the settings are set to look at silicone specifically. So it's much more specific about looking at the silicone and not so specific about looking at the breast tissue. A breast MRI to look to make sure there's no, say, recurrence or soft tissue problems, it sees the implant, but it's not as sensitive at looking for rupture. So it doesn't necessarily give you a complete view of the implant. So the way they set the imaging, and I can't really speak to it more than that, other than it's a different setting.
Yep, and I'd like to just add the second part of that question: signs and symptoms should prompt medical review. I think there are certain things increased swelling, redness. All of a sudden, if you've had your implants for years or whatnot, you notice that one side gets much bigger, maybe without redness. That would prompt an evaluation. We would want to see you in the clinic. If there's fluid around your implant after you've had it for some time, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have the anaplastic large cell lymphoma ALCL. However, allow us to do the evaluation. We would oftentimes get that fluid aspirated, and we will send it off to the lab to have various studies to identify whether it is something to be concerned about or if there needs to be an intervention. But obviously redness can be signs of infection, and that can happen even months to years after reconstruction. So those are things that would prompt you to reach out to us.
Right, and those would be signs and symptoms of that were of concern, but wouldn't necessarily be of the implant rupture.
Right.
And this the last question is an important one, because it talks about the breast implant illness, and really the subtext of that is silicone. You know, do people have idiopathic reactions to silicone that make them ill? So, from 1992 to 2006, every patient that had a silicone implant was on some sort of study. There were different types of studies, adjunct studies, core studies, and multiple different studies. After 2006, there were still some studies that persisted. But really over, 20-something years, we try to get at this issue. And what we found is that, at least epidemiologically, there does not seem to be some sort of constellation of symptoms related to an implant, whether it's intact or ruptured. So there's not an illness to say if you have these three things, you're allergic to silicone. Silicone appears to be one of the only inert substances, so that the body doesn't react to it in the sense of an immune response. And that's been fairly well worked out, that silicone, and again, whether it's a ruptured implant, an intact implant, a saline implant with a silicone jacket, that there does not seem to be any correlation between having an implant and developing, say, connective connective tissue disorders or other diseases. So what I can't tell you is there a patient out there that has a unique response to it? And I never discredit a patient when they are concerned about that. And I certainly will get patients who come saying that they, concerned that their implants, that ever since they had their implants, you know, they've had a number of medical things and they want their implants out. It's not ever our place to discredit that, but it's our place to let them know what we know so far and what would happen if we do that, and then find the right course of action. So at this point, there is no identifiable silicone illness, but it does not mean that there are patients who don't tolerate the implants.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah. We'll move ahead to this idea, and Dr. Tell kind of approached it about a reconstruction under the muscle. Breast seems to be caving at the top of each breast. What can I do? I'll let you go ahead and.
Yeah, sure. It warrants a full evaluation to see how that pocket is, the skin envelope, et cetera. But let's say that everything else is in place and you just notice a hollowing in the upper top of your breast. Oftentimes, if there, I love fat grafting, and I would use that to help me improve the contour in that area. And I think it's a very effective way of doing this. Now, when we do the fat grafting, sometimes my patients will say, oh, none of it took or whatnot. I do generally counsel patients that 60% of it will take. And it's not a hard and fast 60, but generally speaking, that's about the ballpark of how much fat will survive. It also depends on your harvesting technique and things like that. So initially I do kind of warn my patients, you're going to feel a little bit full as there's edema and swelling, and some of that will be resorbed as well, including the fat. And we can reassess that in 3 months, and if it seems that we need to add a little more fat, we can do a second round of it. But oftentimes, I will resort to fat grafting for any contour type issues.
That's exactly that. That is the ideal location,
mm-hmm.
sort of the upper pole of the breast, so the caving in at the top. The cleavage area is a great
mm-hmm.
place. Underneath the mastectomy scar where it's flattened is a great place.
Yep.
And even the lateral contours to kind of fill in, particularly in the armpit where the mastectomy often takes tissue out that makes it difficult to shave in the armpit and
mm-hmm.
it allows us to create a nicer contour there. So fat grafting has been incredibly effective at filling in these areas that are caved in, but also hiding wrinkles and things like that. So whether the implant is above the muscle or below the muscle really isn't the reason for this. The reason for the caving in is that a mastectomy typically goes up to where the collarbone is, whereas we don't want our implants to go up to where the collarbone is, so there's always a transition zone where there's been tissue taken away, but we don't want the implant to go up that high. And so it's about filling in that transition. In terms of exercise after reconstruction, is a nice question about expanders and then had implants pain. Are there any restrictions to doing it, either early on or later on? And is there any consequence of doing reconstruction?
Oftentimes nowadays I do kind of tell patients that you can have it placed under or on top of the muscle, depending on physical activity, et cetera. I do find that immediately postoperatively, patients who have implants or reconstruction on top of the muscle tend to have a little more, less pain. However, as far as exercise restrictions after 7 years, I would say that, the important part of reconstruction is to get back to your usual activity in life. Now, that being said, if you happen to be a bodybuilder and really try to overdevelop the pectoralis muscle, could that affect your ultimate outcome, or could it possibly displace the implant, et cetera. I mean, that is definitely a possibility. As far as a person who's just trying to get back to usual activity and things like that, I would say, yes, you can do those activities. You may notice there may be some changes to your strength, and it could potentially impact the position of the implant as you're doing those activities and things like that. But as far as going back to those activities, I would encourage it.
Right. And I don't think there's anything that I tell patients are a restriction. However, there are some things that patients do which are intensely firing the pectoralis muscle that may be a little uncomfortable, or they have awareness of it. And in that situation, there may be some modification because it just feels better. But I'm not too worried that they will destroy the reconstruction by doing any of that. In fact, I have a patient that just won her age group powerlifting in a Las Vegas thing with her implants under the muscle. I think in general, though, I usually have a philosophy for patients that I like the yoga-type exercises and the isometric-type exercises, the Pilates, things that teach stretch as well as tone, because I think that the implant's better tolerated in that, and you get all the benefits without any of the drawbacks.
I see that we're at an hour, so I want to make sure that we're getting to the questions on tattooing. We've gotten several of those.
So as far as nipple reconstruction is concerned, everything's changed because there's been a fair amount of publicity about tattooing, even artistic tattooing of the breast. In general, with a otherwise balanced reconstruction, I would guess that probably 75% of women go through a reconstructive process where you create the nipple projection and then tattoo the color around it. But now with some local 3D artists and some national 3D national tattoo artists doing 3D tattoos, I think there's some interest in doing that. And usually the interest is because people don't want the nipple show of a nipple reconstruction. And so I think it's an important conversation to have with a plastic surgeon. In general, we can't make a very projected nipple. So nipple show is not usually a big issue. And yet the little bit of shadowing does help the reconstruction. And so I've seen people do 3D tattooing by itself. I've seen people do 3D tattooing after we've done a nipple reconstruction, and I've seen artistic tattoos. I think it's about if most 3D tattooing is done at a place that's a retail place and making sure that the standards of sterility and all that are respected is important. But other than that, I think that it's a canvas that patients certainly have the opportunity to show their empowerment however they feel it's important. And if somebody's interested in doing a 3D tattoo of the nipple, I usually invite them to go online and get a temporary tattoo and try it first, because that looks about as good as anything will ever look. And if that does it for them, then they know that doing a 3D tattoo may be worthwhile. Sometimes people do it and they realize it's just a flat drawing, and it actually doesn't accomplish what they thought it would accomplish.
Yes, and I would say that with the 3D tattooing, some of these places will actually accept insurance, but you do need to ask them about that. And one of the PAs that I work with, also her niche is tattooing, and she got special training from a professional tattoo artist, so she loves to do this. Now, she'll admit she's not a tattoo artist. However, I've seen some of her results, and it is quite beautiful. And
Yeah, most of our nurses have become quite skilled at tattooing without knowing that was something that was going to be part of their profession.
Yeah.
And so what do you recommend? How do people find a good breast tattoo artist?
Word of mouth is actually the best way. So it's really hard for us to recommend a specific person because it's sort of outside. And so really word of mouth. I do have some that I've seen their work, or I've had the opportunity to speak with them and know how they approach it. But it's because it's not held in a medical facility, it's hard for us to vouch for their technique.
Absolutely. If you called the various offices, they may be able to guide you or give some recommendations. But
Well, thank you very much. Again, we've gotten a wealth of information and run over our time. So we just Gracious thanks to our speakers again, Dr. Migliori and Dr. Tuttle, for everyone who's joining us today. Again, please share what you learned today via our social media channels, and please plan to join us for an upcoming webinar and our annual education conference on October 6, 2018. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.
Thank you.